I'm going to call this meeting of the Government Operations Committee to order. We are at a quorum. The first item of business on the agenda is the approval of the minutes for the March 19th meeting. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Okay, that's fair. I have Representative Cagle. It looks like you have the minutes in front of you. Would you like to move the minutes?
Sure, I will move the minutes.
Okay, any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Mariani, we have House File 2550 before us. I will move that House File 2550 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
If you could please present your bill, Chair Mariani.
Very well. Good morning to you. Good morning to members. Mr. Chair, members, House File 2550 comes before this committee by way of the Committee of Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform that I chair, and parts of it from the Subcommittee on Corrections is chaired by my colleague, Representative Considine. In order to ease the time constraints of GovOps to review a number of proposals from our respective committees, we put them together into one bill, House File 2550. These provisions will be amended later on to, assuming everything's good here, on to the Public Safety Criminal Justice Reform Omnibus Bill. I know the jurisdiction here is to review local government impact and state task force proposals, but I want to very quickly just share the big policy frame behind these proposals. So I want to share the state policy goals of these proposals, which is really about advancing what our committees believe are compelling state interests for a number of things. One, reform of our criminal justice system. That, two, protects the constitutional civil rights of Minnesota residents. And three, provide opportunities for offenders to redeem themselves and be welcomed as part of a healthy, productive, peaceful citizenry in our state. So that they can help build up community life in Minnesota, and three, to assist our peace officer community to constantly build up and maintain a high level of objective professionalism that is embraced by our complex, multiracial, multicultural state citizenry. So, Mr. Chair, members, with that, the sections in House File 2550 that I believe are the jurisdictional duty of this committee to review would be sections 11 and 13, which pertains to the creation, or in many ways, well, honestly, really the recreation of the Office of Ombudsman for Corrections. That's Chair Considine's bill and proposal from his committee. Section 23, section 28, which creates a task force on peace officer excellence, and section 29, which creates a task force on dosage probation. Dosage probation is kind of an odd term, but it's basically the ability for those on probation to earn time off, if you will, to limit their length of probation based on quality interventions and skill development, societal adjustment, guided work. So with that, Mr. Chair, I stand open, as well as my colleague, Chairman Considine, to questions that the committee may have.
Thank you, Chair Mariani. Is there anybody who would like to testify in support or opposition to House File 2550? Okay, seeing none, any member discussion? Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to the authors of the bill. I voted for this bill out of corrections and support all of the content within the bill. I do have a question really about the process and the trajectory of the bill. I understand that these are the local kind of the local government impacts and the task force impacts. I guess probably this is better a question for the chair. Why has this bill not been referred and gone through local government, the committee established by the majority to specifically deal with bills that impact local government.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Zerwas. I've said this multiple times, both in local government and here. The standing time for that committee is only once every 2 weeks. We've identified a few specific issues, plus a couple kind of ad hoc issues that we want that committee to focus on. The large one is the whole issue of Met Council governance. That's one issue. Another issue I know that they're interested in looking at is the issue of multi-jurisdictional taxation authority. And then there's been a few specific ones as well, like the preemption bill related to plastic bag issues. Yes, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So is it your assertion that the plastic bag issue should be heard in local government, but creating a state ombudsman and extending their authority to every county jail and their subpoena power and their ability to enter those facilities and examine and interview their employees doesn't impact local government?
I'm not suggesting that it doesn't. I would not suggest that that does not impact local government. There is no rule. This discussion came up on the House floor. There is no rule that every piece of legislation, arguably within the jurisdiction, the subject matter that a subcommittee was created to look at. There is no rule that says that that subcommittee has to hear every bill along those lines.
All right. And then, Mr. Chair, if I can again.
Mm-hmm.
Is it your view that the subcommittee just didn't have enough time to hear this bill?
No. And this bill is also getting, the issues you describe are very relevant to the whole issue of public safety and, the public's, there's long been a tradition, every bill, issues related to the Met Council that deal specifically with the transportation aspect of the Met Council have traditionally been handled in the Transportation Committee. That's a local government thing. Issues related to the county delivery of health care is often handled in the HHS, Committee. This is a public safety related issue. If it's being handled in the Public Safety Committee, as well as here, I think that's a sufficient vetting of the issue.
Well, and I guess, Mr. Chair, if I can continue.
Representative Zerwas.
This really deals with creating a state agency and then empowering that state agency to enter any one of 87 county jails, to issue subpoenas, to begin investigations, and to interview county employees. I think that's what the bill does. I think that's something that probably should be set up in, discussed. If we're going to create a local government committee, it's probably something that should be talked about in a local government committee. Mr. Chair, it's my understanding that the local government subcommittee had a meeting scheduled yesterday that it canceled because there were no items on the agenda. So, Mr. Chair, the majority set up a process. I get it. It's really confusing. We're several months in. I'm still trying to figure it out. Good luck if we're with the public trying to figure it out. But be as it may, the majority set up a process. It set up a committee structure. It set up a committee structure that included subcommittees. One of the subcommittees that was created was Representative Mason's subcommittee for local government. And Mr. Chair, today's agenda is full of bills that impact local government that never went through the local government committee. Representative Mason's bill that's later on the agenda has local government in the title. It never went to the local government committee. So, Mr. Chair, I guess my concern is that the majority apparently has decided that the committee process and the committee structure really doesn't mean anything. There seems to be no intent to follow that process. I guess to the authors of the bill, I fully support what you're doing. I have many provisions that are in the corrections committee report, and I appreciate the work you've done. My concern is with the process, and that the majority, this is another example of the majority creating up a creating a convoluted process and then being unwilling to follow their own set of rules and processes. So, Mr. Chair, at this time, I'd make a motion to refer this bill to the local government committee, and I'd ask for a roll call on that motion, Mr. Chair, because if we're not going to talk about these issues that directly impact 87 counties in a local government committee, we probably shouldn't have a local government committee.
Okay. Mr. Representative Zerwas, I would just dispute your assertion that we're not following our process. Our process has been consistent, and it's consistent with other types of bills that are out there. Like I said, this does relate to local government, but it's primarily a public safety issue. It's consistent with what we've done in the past, whether we're talking about the issue of health care, delivery by counties, or transportation. I don't think we should hold up the bill. So I would ask members to vote no. I saw both chairs there wanting to comment on this.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's not my role to be involved in the conversation among committee members here about their understanding of their scope. That's for the committee to determine. But I do want to reassure members that these provisions, as in fact Representative Sirwas alluded to, by virtue of having provisions within here, so I don't hear any resistance to the concept. But in terms of process, I just want to reassure members that these provisions were deliberated in two committees, in Chairman Considine's committee, which is the subcommittee on corrections. We spent time, we had amendments, we had lengthy debate within that venue. We had interested parties, stakeholders, governmental units come and testify for and against the provisions. We made some adjustments. We then had a lesser length hearing, but nonetheless a good hearing and debate in the full public safety criminal justice reform committee. It absolutely is appropriate that it come this way. My understanding is that this committee certainly right here, right now, has the jurisdiction to raise the concerns that Representative Sirwas has indicated ought to be raised and shared and talked about. We're fully prepared to engage in that conversation. And members, the path for this is to go back towards the eventually to the Public Safety Criminal Justice Reform Committee, where no doubt we will continue to debate and make amendments as we prepare our omnibus provisions. So I just want to lay out for folks what I think has been a pretty a rigorous process of reviewing these proposals.
Okay. Chair Considine, you raised your hand.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate Representative Zerwas's passion and input, and he does have a number of provisions in this bill. We had a very nice bipartisan. The only thing I would point out, though, is that there's nothing in the bill that is exclusively to local government. It is. It started off some provisions were put in that included local government, but I think that it fits nicely into the government operations. Whereas if it was something that was in the bill that I thought was exclusively for local government, I would be tempted to support Representative Zerwas, but I don't see anything that actually falls into that category. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and let's start digging into the content, so we can, vet and discuss.
We do
portions of this.
Yeah, we.
Oh, that's right. We've got the motion. Okay. So that the
you're first on the list when we discuss the content, though.
All right.
Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just like to say, speaking as the vice chair of the local government committee and someone with over 20 years of experience in local government, that looking at the content of this particular bill, I'm not seeing things in here that I, as a former local elected official, would have anything significant to contribute to the contents of this bill, and don't see any reason why the contents of this bill should be coming to us in local government.
Yep. Thank you. Okay, Representative Mason.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a comment that, and you had outlined what the main objectives of the local government committee were for, but I also want to emphasize that the committee members were requested or advised that if there's any bill that they wanted to hear, we could pull it into the committee. And that, so any bill that is even the, would be slightly applicable, if there's a committee member that wanted to hear it, we would do that. And this was not one of them.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Mason, I don't see any additional discussion. There's been a roll call requested, so the clerk will take the roll. This is on the motion to re-refer to the Zerwas motion to re-refer to the local government subcommittee.
Representative Freiberg.
No.
Representative Sauk.
No.
Representative Bonner.
No.
Representative Elkins.
No.
Representative Gomez.
No.
Representative Cagle.
No.
Representative Lee.
No.
Representative Lilly.
No.
Representative Mason.
No.
Representative Nelson.
No.
Representative Pulowski.
No.
Representative Zerwas.
Yes.
Representative Heinrich.
Yes.
Representative Lehman.
Yes.
Representative Nash. Representative Quam.
Aye, aye.
Representative Tice.
No. Yes.
Representative Vogel.
Yes.
Representative West.
There being six ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail. To the substance of the bill, Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And, you know, noticing the portion of the bill in regards to the ombudsperson, other than not being able to levy a complaint fee, the powers seem to be very broad and extensive. I'm curious on page 8, 8.4, and in that section of where neither the ombudsperson or, I'm sorry, ombudsman, as stated in the bill, nor any member of the ombudsman's staff shall be compelled to testify or produce evidence in any judicial or administrative proceedings with respect to any matter involving the exercises of the duties, etc. So I'm trying to understand, if you're a local governmental entity and you are researching a complaint or some issue, once the ombudsperson's involved and they come in, and it also says later on that basically they can come in at any time unannounced, and they can subpoena and grab and get information, how do you handle the conflict and disruption of the local administrative proceedings that may have been going on? You know, so local government's doing something and this entity can swoop in, grab stuff, disrupt that, and then doesn't have to share any of the information, doesn't have to come in and testify or speak to the local government. Isn't that just running roughshod over our local government?
Chair Considine?
No.
Representative Quam.
Well, apparently we have a different opinion of local government and, you know, Big Brother, so to speak, being able to disrupt with no input, partnership, teamwork, cooperation. There are other adjectives we could add in there. And I don't see in the bill here that it allows for any of those things, cooperation, teamwork, etc. with local government. I thought that we worked together to serve our public. Am I missing something that's in the bill that's...
Let me go back.
Representative Considine.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Quam, it says that except as may be necessary to enforce the provisions of sections 241.9 to 241.495, things that have to do with the Ombudsman Office. I believe this is just trying to protect this from a fishing expedition. That's my interpretation of it.
Representative Quam?
Well, why don't we have nonpartisan House staff enlighten us? Because when I see proceedings with respect to any matter involving the exercise of the Ombudsman's official duties, except as may be necessary, so that I would think that that would be the opposite of what the representative just stated, that it would have. Well, let us have nonpartisan staff enlighten us on those two sections, 241.90 to 241.95.
Mr. Gehring?
Is that Mr. I defer to Jeff Diebel, who's my colleague who works on this bill.
Okay. Sure. Welcome. Please identify yourself, since we're and
Mr. Chair, my name is Jeff Diebel. I work in House Research.
Great. Glad to have you here. Thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
This, just as some background, this language was taken verbatim from when the Ombudsman existed in statute about 15 years ago. So this was the structure that was there. I don't have any special knowledge as to why this provision was included with the original bill. I suspect that the Ombudsman is intended to be above the influence of governmental entities, and so to the extent that they may be brought into a lawsuit and as a means of curtailing their authority or pressuring them to discontinue a lawsuit, I think this is intended probably to give them some protection from that.
Representative Quam?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but I think I requested that we hear what is actually in this part of the statute so that we can understand, that it's being referenced, because I feel that state, local government, and the agencies that serve our public ought to be able to work together, cooperate, and et cetera. And I'd like to understand where the exceptions and the, big brother, I can do whatever I want to, comes into effect.
Mr. Diebel?
Mr. Chair and members, the statutory references on line 8.11, that's the new language for the Ombudsman. So that's the range of statutes that we're coding these as. So 241.90 is the Ombudsman statutes that we are trying to put back into statute with this bill.
Representative Quam?
Okay, so why don't I go back to my first base question. What protections are there that a local government entity who is in the process of doing something, they're already investigating something that's happening at their facility, and someone decides, well, I'll throw a wrench in it, and I'll make a complaint, and the Ombudsman comes in, and because of the structure of the complaint, subpoenas and grabs evidence, it disrupts what is going on at the local facility, but then doesn't have to talk to the local facility, administrative proceedings, doesn't have to testify, doesn't have to share any of the data and evidence, and frankly, that evidence could very well be the same evidence that they had been procuring for their administrative activity. So where are the protections in this bill? That's where I started out to, and then the person testified, or the representative, referenced some stuff, and I said, well, let's try to understand this, because frankly, this probably would have happened in the aforementioned subcommittee, but since it didn't, I figure that we ought to actually have the discussion, because part of the biggest problem I hear from my local government entities is that they aren't heard, that there's not the teamwork and cooperation that there ought to be. And if we're going to recreate or create an entity with broad powers, I want some reassurances just how they'll be able to cooperate and work with local government. And that's what I'm trying to find out. So if I could actually get an answer to what I'm trying to find out, as opposed to running around the circle, we probably can more effectively move on through the rest of my questions, you know, digging into the portions of the bill that affect local government.
Chair Mariani.
Mr. Chair, and members, and we did spend quite a bit of time in both committees, so particularly in the Corrections Committee, a bit in Judiciary as well, around some of these issues. In fact, we heard from the first ombuds person who served in this capacity, and under that framework, arguably there were even broader powers that existed under that framework. Mr. Stiebel's correct. This is about making sure that the office is not influenced by bias. The intent is to be an objective third-party reviewer of complaints and potential violations of the rights of all the all the participants within the corrections system. And so to a large degree, this really operates under that philosophy of the role of the ombudsperson isn't to punish anyone. It isn't to create an action against anyone, as much as it is to work toward creating open communications, open understanding from a third-party perspective of what the facts are in any given case, and then allow the process, whatever investigatory process, whether it's the Department of Corrections or your local sheriffs, to be able to play itself out, but to play itself out within the context of the third party objective, taking no sides reviewer that's laying out factual information. And absolutely diving into whether or not there may be cases of violations of constitutional rights here. In the past ombudsperson, there was never any overreach. It's documented. There's no overreach in terms of an abusive, if you will, don't put your words, but an abusive application of any of these powers. And in fact, that ombudsperson, if I remember the testimony correctly, I don't think ever used its subpoena power. You know, it had the subpoena power as an ability to have a serious conversation with folks. It is absolutely our intent, and it's good to get it on the record, Representative Fong, so I'm glad you raised the question. It's absolutely our intent that that be the way in which this office operates. Obviously, you have to have the tools there in order to compel, if you need to compel, cooperation from all the interested parties. But frankly, its effectiveness historically for us has not been based on actually using the hammer as much as it's been about bringing people to the table and laying out the facts of what may or may not have occurred.
Okay. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate that they never used the subpoena power. And in fact, you know, I think it's rare, but it's not unheard of because, well, the legislative auditor, for the first time ever, was forced to use the subpoena power to get information So it is there. And our discussion is very good, but I didn't hear one single thing of what is in this bill that's proposing to protect local governments and, you know, do a partnership. I hear intent. Intent is good, but I've seen many pieces of legislation pass through. When it's implemented, they'll testify. I was in a committee where they testified, Department of Ed, well, this was the legislative intent. The chair of the committee said, well, that was my bill. This is the committee we heard it in. And no way was that our legislative intent. So unless we specifically have mechanisms in here to protect local government and that they can have some reassurances, then I don't know what might happen in the future. 2 years ago, we probably would never have thought that the legislative auditor would have to subpoena. So things happen, and I'm just trying to make sure the bill has something in it that local government can feel that there's some protection on that. And fine if other committees have discussed it, but they're discussing, you know, reference to the corrections, reference to public safety. But this committee, as it was stated by the chair, we've got domain of that includes local government. Since it wasn't covered in the local government subcommittee, you know, we should do our due diligence and actually cover it in this committee that has that jurisdiction. So again, I ask, what in this bill can reassure local government that they won't be trampled by and that there will be a teamwork, cooperative effort, because we're all supposed to be working in service to our citizens.
Representative Quam, the subpoena power is not, you know, we've heard from the testifiers, the subpoena power is not that unusual. I'm just looking at the statute relating to the Ombudsman of the Department of Human Services in section 245.94 here. The language is pretty similar in both provisions. I know that in the legislature, I didn't know this until recently, but we actually have subpoena power as well, and that's been the topic of some debate recently. I think as you noted yourself, it's not something a power that's exercised frequently by many of these different levels of government, but it is helpful, I think, to have it there.
Well, Mr. Chair, the discussion of subpoena came up because the author of the bill mentioned it, and I used that as an example of things pop up that we don't anticipate. And I repeatedly returned to the base reason and query for the line of questioning is what is present in this bill that would help protect or reassure or promote the teamwork cooperation with local government? And that's the core thing I've been asking, and that's what I'm trying to find. I mean, apparently the author's been through a few different committees, extensive discussions. I thought it'd be easy for the author to be able to pop up and be able to point that out to me. So again, I resubmit the question, what is in this bill that will protects local government and promotes the cooperative effort and work with them?
Thank you, Representative Quam. I mean, I guess speaking for me, I'm given some consolation that the language is very similar in both provisions and it has been rarely used. I don't know, Chair Considine or Chair Mariani, do you have any additional comments?
I'm not sure exactly who we are protecting them from. I'm having a little bit of trouble understanding the representative's concern. Section 10.1, investigation of local jails and detention facilities, either the ombudsman or the jail inspection unit of the Department of Corrections may investigate complaints involving local jails and detention facilities. The ombudsman and Department of Corrections must enter into an arrangement with one another to ensure they're not duplicating services. I'm again unclear of exactly who we're protecting folks from here, though.
Thank you, Chair Considine. Representative Guam, you may want to move on to your next line.
Mr. Chair, well, frankly, administrative proceedings, so local, our local facilities, they oftentimes will be investigating, doing it, that I assume that's what you're referencing with administrative proceedings. And therefore, if they're in the middle of it, this bill appears to, you know, plainly state the ombudsman can go in, disrupt those proceedings, can take whatever evidence they don't have to. Later on, it says that they don't have to, at any time, enter and inspect at any time premises within the control of the administrative agency. So, without warning, they could go in, and during that investigation, it's reasonable that they would be taking the same evidence that the local administrative authority would be looking at, which, frankly, if your evidence is gone, it's hard for you to do your job like you have been. And, that's disruptive. That's interfering with an ongoing activity of the local administration. Your thing about not overlapping services, I don't think addresses this. So I just want to, I would love to have somewhere in this bill that said that they would come to agreement about cooperating on, or they would share the evidence when you're in the, if you're both doing the same thing, Big Brother comes in and says, it's all mine, and, tough luck on you. Well, that doesn't make for teamwork and cooperation. So unless there's language that actually addresses this, maybe the author can agree to look at trying to improve this, but I'd like reassurances more than just the intent, because I have to do it on the merits of what's in the bill. And I've been asking repeatedly, tell me what's in the bill that makes me feel more comfortable and easier.
Chair Mariani.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Klum, it's not my intent to get into a heated debate with you, but I have to say that, when we load up the description of this about people knocking on doors, or not even knocking on doors, but showing up uninvited, Big Brother, this is the opposite of that. And I don't think it really helps our discussion to frame it in the way that at times you may be framing it. If you look on page 10, the ombudsman, all this is going to culminate in a series of recommendations to make the system, our process, and the realities of everyone within our correction system, both resident inmates, detainees, and the people who work there, to make that system a good, safe system that respects and follows Minnesota laws, follows the constitutional protections that all Minnesotans are afforded. If you look down to 10.18 to 10.20, if the ombudsman has reason to believe that there's been something terrible amiss here, then the ombudsman refers the matter to the appropriate authorities. So then we rest back on our current existent vetting processes, with all the due process and transparency that it involves in terms of addressing whatever the ombudsman may have found is a violation. And it's interesting because that actually extends even, if you go further down, to the ombudsperson bringing to the attention of the governor and the legislature if, as a result of his or her review and investigation, he or she determines that, it's the legislature, it's the lawmakers that kind of set this up, and they really need to seriously, reconsider, the statutory framework that they put forward. This whole thing reeks of a culture of cooperation, of a culture of assistance, not a culture of Big Brother, not a culture of a heavy hand, not at all. We heard extensively from the first ombudsperson. He made it real clear that the only way that he was going to be successful and that this office was going to carry out our shared obligation to guarantee the constitutional rights of everyone in the state of Minnesota, that you don't, stormtroop your way into whatever the issue is, that you build the relationships and you build them in an objective manner so that you're not seen as the person that's standing up for detainees. You're not seen as the person that's standing up for guards. You're seen as an objective reviewer of facts that's going to provide information so that our existing systems deliberation over whether or not violations have occurred or not can then be informed. So point to that behavior, point to, on page 10 where all this culminates and then to put on the record, what our intent is, I don't know what further I could do to answer any of your, concerns. They're not illegitimate concerns. I'm just, coming straight back at you in terms of how this is structured and what our intent is.
Representative Constein.
Let's just change one word in your question, which is disrupt and to help facilitate. That's what the intent of the bill is to help local jurisdictions with matters of communication, with investigations. It's not to disrupt, it's to help facilitate.
Thank you. Are there additional member questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam,
we've been going for
about half an hour.
I understand that, and if we could have gotten straight to the discussion we just had, it would have taken out a lot of the time.
But we do have a room tomorrow if we need to come back to finish this up.
Well, thank you for that information clarification, Mr. Chair. But, Mr. Chair, the intent is to try and improve this. I like having ombuds people. I just want to make sure that it's clear and there's stuff in the bill that we have it as a cooperative. Because when you have a cooperative nature, then things work and improve. But if it's confrontational, then we've got problems. Plus, I don't want a situation where somebody could be mischievous, because some of our inmates might be tempted to be mischievous. And if there's an investigation, throw a wrench in the work, delay everything by doing it. And so I would hope that the author would look at taking care of some of these concerns. Thank you.
Are there additional member questions or comments? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Mariani?
I'm sorry?
Do you have any closing remarks, Representative Considine?
Thank you. Mr. Quam, Representative Quam, T. Williams, the former ombudsman, laid out what I believe is the best outline of how an ombudsman should work. And I'm going to try to get his presentation and have it sent to you. I think that alone will reassure you a lot. It did me. And in fact, I wish to take him at some point to a couple prisons settings and have him explain to both and staff his concepts on how this is supposed to work. And so I'll try to get that and get it forwarded to you. I think you'll find that very reassuring.
Thank you, Representative Constein. If you could actually send that to our committee staff as well, we can make sure it's distributed to all committee members.
Appreciate your support, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. So seeing no further discussion, I will renew my motion that House File 2550 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mason, you have House File 132.
Good
see. Okay, so I will move that House File 132 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Oh, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Chair Mason, please present your bill.
Thank you, Chair, members. This bill is basically a common sense or preventative measure, and it impacts the operation of state government. The bill is, had already passed both houses once, but was vetoed last year in that budget bill. While it's in response to the Menlars and Minnesota eligibility technology system problems, it does codify user acceptance testing so that it will be routine when implementing any new system or application functionality for an existing business software application that significantly impacts the operations of a local government or businesses that are also impacted. To provide opportunities for user acceptance testing when local governments will be the primary users. The testing can be foregone if it is determined to be unfeasible or not necessary by the agency commissioner in consultation with local government representatives and the chief information officer. User acceptance testing is not required for routine software upgrades or application changes necessary to comply with federal laws or regulations. Mr. Chair, that's the bill, and I have Keith Carlson involved here to testify.
Sure. Before you do, I understand we have a DE1 amendment also that I think would put the bill mostly in the shape people want it, and we can discuss the rest of that part a little bit later. Would you like me to move the DE1 amendment?
I would like to have, yes, please move that.
Okay, I will move the DE1 amendment. Any discussion? Okay, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion carries. The bill's in the shape you'd like it. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, which supports this bill, and it is also supported by the Association of Minnesota Counties. Clearly, this bill just codifies what should be common sense, that before you put out business software in the field, that it should receive user acceptance or field testing before it is implemented statewide. Obviously, it's in response to the Minlars debacle, as well as the Minnesota eligibility technology system that's used for determining eligibility to medical assistance and Medicare that has also been very problematic since its initial implementation. We support the bill. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 132? Okay, seeing none, member discussion, Representative Elkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to say I'm going to anticipate what he's going to say probably, but I think an argument could have been made that on this one that it should have gone to local government as well, but I think in this case I don't think there would have been any real benefit to it because this one is so straightforward and so commonsensical that I don't think any value would have been derived from that extra stop.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Elkins. Representative Zerwas.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I think if this would have followed the proper procedure and been referred to local government, there likely wouldn't be three attempts at getting an amendment right in a committee before it goes to the General Register. Just a thought, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members, I was approached yesterday by some folks working closely with Representative Mason on this bill, trying to ensure that the intent of the bill language as it's redrafted in the DE1 amendment that's now been adopted by the committee really accomplishes what folks are setting out to do, and that is allow for end users to be part of the testing process, and quite frankly, require that end users are a part of the testing process. The challenge is that while the now amended language provides local government units to be part of the testing processes, as most of us know because we've talked about the impact of the Minlars rollout and the failed Minlars rollout and the devastating financial impact that's had on our private deputy registrars, that under the bill's current construct, as amended with the DE1 amendment, all this work in deputy registrars still wouldn't be part of the testing process, and so still likely wouldn't have averted the disaster that was the Minlars rollout, costing deputy registrars, in some instances, their businesses, in other instances, their homes, and much of their livelihoods. And so the A1 amendment was the first iteration to say government and business users. The A2 fixes a typographical error in the A1. And the A3, Mr. Chair, which was submitted after the amendment deadline when we got some feedback that said they'd like to further define primary user and then spell it out and restrict it to the privately owned deputy registrar offices and licensed agents providing services on behalf of the DNR. That's the language that stakeholders kind of arrived at last night. As you can see, it was after 5 p.m. Mr. Chair, if we look back to last week, custom and usage of this committee is to allow amendments to be offered that didn't meet the 24. I can't even say that with a straight face. I tricked you to do it once. But my hope is that we can adopt the A3 here in committee, Mr. Chair, here today, or Mr. Chair, I would move that we lay the bill over until our next committee hearing, post the amendment, and move forward. I make that recommendation in the most friendly of intents, because I think bringing this bill with the amended DE1 language that still doesn't address the concern from our private deputy registrars would make for a prolonged and interesting floor discussion. And I think it's easiest, perhaps, if, along with consensus of the committee, perhaps waive the 24-hour rule, which is under your discretion, and move the bill along.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. There's a lot there to respond to. Just initially, I would just, again, question the premise that this did not follow the proper procedure. I think this followed the procedure that's there. There's no requirement that every bill touching on local government or on elections, for that matter, be referred to either of those two subcommittees. I will say, though, I don't have a problem with this amendment. I mean, I do think we retain, you know, we, as the committee, we do have the authority to waive the committee deadline for amendments, and I would be okay doing so in this case. I do think if members do object, I might be inclined to lay this over so we can, because I do intend this bill to move forward till next week, but I don't know that it's necessary. In my mind, this amendment simply clarifies the definition of business users that was in the A2 amendment, which was submitted on time. So I don't see a problem with it. My preference actually would be to just see the deadline waived in this point. I have checked in with the people from the administration and so forth, and I know that they have no concerns with this language as well. So Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Zerwas. I don't have a problem with the amendment, well, a real problem with the amendment, but overall, I mean, the reason that I included the business users is for the exact reason of those specific examples. But I guess I do question whether it's really appropriate for us to have that specific information in legislation, because there might come a day when another agency or something could fall under this. And if we're just going to limit it to those two things, I see that as a problem.
I guess to this point, Representative Zerwas, I do have two other members on the list also.
I guess, Mr. Chair, I apologize. I was under the assumption that the A3 would be a friendly amendment, so I'll withdraw the A3.
Okay, that's your prerogative. I might be inclined to offer it myself here. So I do think it provides clarity. Representative Mason,
I'm okay accepting it. It's just the fact that for future things, but I understand that it would like to have this. So if you want to go ahead and add it, that will be fine.
Okay. Representative Elkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, first of all, that the example involving Minlars is not really applicable. In fact, the deputy registrars were invited to participate in the end user testing for Minlars. Some of them did, but in the end, the overall user acceptance testing for Minlars was inadequate. But in large part, that was because the funding for the consultant that was hired to create the test plan was terminated 6 months before Minlars went live, and had no opportunity to participate in the execution of the test plan that they had created. And I think probably partially as a result of that, the engagement of the deputy registrars was inadequate. Relatively few of them availed themselves of the opportunity to participate in the end-user acceptance testing. And clearly, you look at the aftermath, and it was obvious that the user acceptance testing was inadequate. I think that I would oppose all of the amendments for the fact, and I'm guessing that Representative Bonner is going to want to weigh in here this as well.
She would be next on the list.
Okay. The fact that the term in the DE amendment refers to user acceptance testing, which means that by definition it's the end users who are doing the testing. So it's not necessary to further qualify the language as it exists in the DE amendment. It's the changes are superfluous, and so. I will be voting against all of the amendments, because I think the language in the DE amendment is clear and adequate.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Elkins. That's helpful. Representative Bonner?
Yes, thank you. First of all, I want to thank you, Representative Mason and Mr. Chair, and thank you for bringing this forward. Just to be clear, acceptance testing is generally accepted as best practice, in standard practice in the industry. So it seems a little interesting that we should have to spell that out, to be very frank with you. So I have no objection, of course, to suggesting that we use best practice. So thank you for that. And in fact, I actually am really good with the DE amendment and adding that additional language.
Hold on.
Are we okay?
Is everybody okay over there? I'm not sure what happened.
Okay.
Okay. Okay.
Yep.
Sorry, continue, Representative.
Yes, Moore. And I was going to say, so I have a couple of questions. Actually, I have one question for clarification from Representative Zerwas, if I could.
Hardly anything. Advantage of it,
because is that possible?
I guess, yeah. I mean, we don't really yield in committee, but yeah, just go ahead with your question.
Representative Zerwas, so you mentioned that this amendment came from various stakeholders. Is that the deputy registrar, or who were the stakeholders that were consulted in this?
Representative Zerwas, if you care to answer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Carlson was the one that brought me the A3.
Yeah, Mr. Carlson, did you, maybe, yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members, just try and clarify this situation. The intent all along was that all deputy registrars be covered under this amendment. I was approached by the lobbyists for the private deputies to make it absolutely clear that they be included under this legislation, and brought the issue to Representative Mason, who was agreeable to that. Initially, the draft that was proposed by the private deputies was using this broader term of business users. I ran that by Minute. They were somewhat concerned that they couldn't clearly identify a specific user group that they would have to liaise with to see if not the user acceptance testing was necessary. And through dialogue between the three of us, we came to the conclusion that the private deputy registrars has referenced in the A3 amendment, as well as the DNR license agents, which frequently is a service that is also provided by deputy registrars, would encompass the concerns, and consequently the A3 meets the concerns that were identified by the A3 and is acceptable to Minute for the reasons that I just enumerated.
Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that clarification, Representative Zerwas, and to our testifier. So I'll say in quite honestly, you know, when we talk about the term business user versus primary user, depending on the scenario, those could actually be used interchangeably. So I'm not sure if it adds any additional clarification or value. But the other piece of this, and although I honestly I'm not necessarily opposed per se, although Representative Elkin's point, it's kind of redundant and maybe perhaps not really necessary, because again, we are talking about user acceptance testing, which means the actual users in this case, so it's kind of superfluous. But the other thing I wanted to bring up, and this is where I'm actually a little bit, I understand the intent of the A3, but the one thing that makes me a little bit concerned, and I think Representative Mason brought it up as well, is that in 0.16 here, where we talk about the primary user in this section means a local unit of government, but then it goes on to discuss, and it calls out specifically in lines 1.7 and 1.8, the privately owned deputy registrar's office or a licensed licensing agent providing service on behalf of the Department of Natural Resources. My concern with this particular couple of lines is that if we're talking about putting something into statute about user acceptance testing, this feels like it's actually limiting us for future reference. I certainly, if it were to say something like, and may include but is not limited to, if you really feel strongly that you need to call it out, but I almost would be tempted to not do that simply because, again, I think having in statute language that actually limits our ability going forward in the future would probably not be best practice.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Bonner. It sounds like there's still plenty of discussion about the amendment, so since it did not meet the deadline, in my mind, we don't need to offer it. So any additional discussion to the bill? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks? Representative Zerwas.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess if we're not going to add any of the amendments onto the bill, and if that's the decision of the majority, I do have concerns that as we move forward, we're going to be putting forth software that doesn't involve key stakeholders in the process. I think we're setting ourselves up for a repeat of whether it's the METS system that didn't appropriately involve county participation, or whether it's the MNLAR system that didn't appropriately utilize our private deputy registrars. I I think that's a real bad idea. I think passing this on to the General Register for a floor debate is going to be unfortunate. I think you're opening yourselves up to a pretty involved discussion on the floor. I guess I'd have a question to the bill author. If Representative Mason can point out where within the now amended language, which line will require state agencies to work with private deputy registrars as they roll out new software or software improvements.
Representative Mason?
Okay, it does, you know, if we use it as business users, it will not specifically say deputy registrars. Am I answering your question?
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And from the existing DE1 language, if we're not going to do any amendments today in committee, where in the existing DE1 language does it call out that we need to provide testing with private deputy registrars?
Representative Mason, or Mr. Carlson, or
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Zerwas, you're correct that the DE1 amendment does not include a specific reference to business users. It is only referencing local government users.
And so, Mr. Chair,
Representative Zerwas, hold on one second. Representative Mason or Mr. Carlson, would you be okay if we laid this over until next week to try to see if these language issues can be addressed?
That would be fine.
Okay. With that, I'm going to lay this bill over. Representative Gomez. Okay.
And if you have viewers, you don't want to be asked to ask me more questions because Christine and I will be all over this one.
Welcome to the committee. Would you understand your bill is going to Ways and Means and you have an amendment also? Did you want to move it or would you like me to?
Yeah, I'd like to move the DE1 amendments, please.
Well, actually, how about you move the bill first?
Move the bill first.
So, Representative Gomez moves that House File 2249 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. And do you have a DE1 amendment? Would you like to move that? And is that just to put it in the shape you'd like it?
Yes, please, Mr. Chair. Okay.
Any discussion to the amendment?
Okay. Can I say something
about
it?
Yeah, go for it.
I just wanted to point out that the House research brief reflects the bill as introduced and not the DE amendment. So while it says there that the licensure requirements eliminated for both individual eyelash technicians and for salons, it's the DE1 amendment does not remove the licensure requirement for individual technicians.
Okay.
So it's a substantive change. I just wanted to point that out.
Any additional discussion on the amendment? Okay, so to the DE1 amendment, all those in favor of adopting the amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Gomez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. So HF 2249 exempts licensed eyelash technicians from the Cosmetology Board's facility licensing requirements. So before 2016, eyelash providers were not regulated in Minnesota. In 2016, the legislature created an occupational license, and the license was created in response to the Cosmetology Board's decision to start requiring eyelash providers to become licensed estheticians. So this bill doesn't modify the occupational license for eyelash extension providers. They still have to get 38 hours of training and are required to comply with infection control standards. But in 2016, the law also required that eyelash technicians worked in licensed salons and gave the board the power to establish the conditions for getting an eyelash salon license. So if you're running a licensed salon, you have to either yourself or be certified as a salon manager, or you have to hire one. This requires 2,700 hours of experience, and so in passing an exam, and then also, you know, if you're like a full licensed salon, then you have to meet certain physical requirements in the space, including, you know, certain kinds of sinks and doorways, and you'll hear from the testifier that individual providers have had to, you know, spend a bunch of money to kind of to modify spaces physically in a way that I think is kind of unnecessary. So yeah, it created a barrier to having these businesses. There's an article in your packet from NPR about the impact that this is having on eyelash businesses owned by people of color. Like I said, eyelash technicians are required to comply with the licensure requirements of the Board of Cosmetology. And if they're in a commercial space, they also have to comply with local building codes. And so this just, you know, exempts them from that, the requirement around operating as a licensed salon. And I would ask for your support. I have a couple testifiers. We can do that how you would like.
Okay, thank you, Representative Gomez. We do have another couple bills on the agenda, so I'm going to ask testifiers to keep their remarks to about 3 minutes if possible. So welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Brenda Tots. I live in Alexandria, Minnesota. I have been an eyelash technician for about 13 years. And I've owned my own eyelash salon for about 9 years, and I'm in support of this bill for three reasons. First, last year, in order to keep my business, I needed to install plumbing and three hand washing sinks in a one-level building that's less than 1,000 square feet due to the facility license requirements, and I don't own the facility. So that ended up costing me almost $9,000, and along with that, the owner allowed me to make those changes as long as I agree to removing the sinks and the plumbing upon leaving, and I don't know what that will cost. Secondly, I'm paying for two facility licenses. I also do permanent makeup, so I do have a facility license through the Board of Health and now also the Board of Cosmetology. So it makes me feel like the state's double dipping. Lastly, I do support the bill for all the future women entrepreneurs. My daughter and daughter-in-law who work with me would not have been able to afford to make these changes and requirements on their own. And unfortunately, other women have also had to close their business for that reason. I feel that the facility license is burdensome, it's unnecessary. Especially since all eyelash technicians are still required to follow those standards of cleanliness and sanitation that are held accountable with our individual licenses. Thank you. I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Ms. Potts. I appreciate your remarks. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Lee McGrath. I'm the legislative counsel for the Institute for Justice. My colleagues and I support House File 2249 for numerous reasons, but I will just say, to be brief today, that this is an opportunity bill. This is a bill that gives members the chance to realize in practice what is often said about commitments to small business owners, women-owned businesses, and minority-owned businesses. Minnesota should be the land of opportunity. It should be a place where it is relatively easy to meet the first rung of the economic ladder, and this bill is consistent with our values about opportunity for all. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Is there anybody else that wants to testify to this bill? Come down. Please introduce yourself and give us your testimony.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jim Hurst. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Salon and Spa Professional Association, a trade group representing the licensed cosmetologists, nail technicians, as well as estheticians, and that also includes eyelash extension technicians. My comments will be very brief, and regrettably, I have to say that we are opposed to this approach. For background information, that is correct, 3 years ago, legislation was passed to recognize the growing aspect of this business, and we agreed with the proponents of this bill then that a special exemption needed to be made to assist these practitioners so that they did not have to take what was then 1,550 hours of education as well as additional hours if they were an esthetician. But suffice it to say, there was agreement 3 years ago that licensing was a critical component of this. Without licensing, there is no check to make sure that these facilities are abiding by what is critical for maintaining the health, safety, and protection of the clients that seek out these services. There is a handout that we have supplied with you, and it will show on the second page the very frightening and real risks that are involved if proper infection control is not abided by. Only by licensing these facilities is the state able to go and make visits to these locations to make sure that this is abided by. I will close by saying the association that I represent conducts what are called compliance classes, whereby when people are found by the state to be negligent or not fully complying with these measures, they come to these classes. Recently, just a couple weeks ago, we had one individual who's a rather high-profile owner-operator of eyelash extension clinics, salons, and he walked away saying, "I am so glad that I took this class, this remedial class. This is something that I am responsible for, and if I hadn't have been inspected as a licensed salon, the damages potentially to my clients were very real." And he said also that licensing is an important component to make sure that this continues. For those reasons, Mr. Chairman, I will suspend my comments. Certainly welcome any comments that you may have, but thank you.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. I've got a list of people that have identified as wanting to testify, so I'll just go through the list. Gina Fast, is that okay? Please come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Gina Fast. I'm the Executive Director for the Board of Cosmetology. As you are aware, the Board is statutorily mandated to protect the citizens' health and safety through regulating cosmetology-related professions, licensing, inspecting, compliance, writing rules, in particular to promoting infection control standards, including eyelash extensions. We are opposed to this bill. As stated earlier, the eyelash extension legislation driven by eyelash technicians originally agreed upon by both of the testifiers before me was recently settled after years of debate and was finalized by the through our rulemaking in the Office of Administrative Hearings in 2017. All rules related to eyelash extensions passed with no hearing. If we would have received 25 requests, a hearing would have been required. Further, there was an amended version previously introduced at one point for full deregulation, and a similar bill last year was vetoed by Governor Dayton. Currently, we have about 250 licensed eyelash technicians and 40 salons that likely do eyelash extensions only. I want to clarify that eyelash extensions have always been a part of the cosmetology scope of practice, but rules were recently updated to clarify several services included in this regulation, which prompted the eyelash extension only license. I'm completely perplexed how year after year the issue of regulation, partial regulation, and deregulations continues to arise. This is confusing for the public, service providers. service providers. I'm trying to go paper-free here. It's confusing for the public service providers, and we've already had several calls about confusion, frustration, and disbelief. I listened to testimony from each year from 2016 in both the House and the Senate, and it was overwhelmingly clear legislators wanted regulation of this procedure as it was close to the eye, where delicate service is done. Glues and adhesives are used, eye packs with gel are used to the skin, and eye disease is an injury, along with understanding the proper practice of infection control, which all included licensing and inspections. Common sense was a primary theme through this. In fact, when an amendment was introduced to attempt to completely deregulate it, it did not pass, and many of the members were very concerned about the deregulation approach. It was stated that a do-nothing approach and the limited specialty license, which is now in current law, seems to accomplish what everyone is looking for oversight and inspections, which is a primary reason we have the Board of Cosmetology. I do not believe infection control standards for this procedure or the expectation have changed since this legislation has come before you in the past. However, it is not me who can decide if the public should be on their own. Facilities will attempt to self-regulate. Most board complaints are not consumer filed. They are filed based upon repeated inspections with lack of compliance. Again, complaints are from the Board of Cosmetology inspectors doing their job on inspections in the field. I'm also concerned that the approach from the drivers of this bill appears to be focused on injuries or that it's too hard to get a salon license. We issue nearly 750 salon licenses a year. People are complying with salon license requirements all the time. Legislators, from previous testimony, don't want to wait to have an injury happen before we regulate. We want clean salons to avoid the risk of injury. It'd be like waiting for someone to lose eyesight before doing anything. Further, many people don't go running to state agencies to save the day and file complaints. They go to get their injuries fixed. They go to eye doctors. They go to physicians to clear their problems. They might seek a complaint against salon's professional liability insurance, and with no salon licensing, there is no guarantee that there will be any liability insurance required to be complied with. Board inspectors, while visiting salons, are generally not witness to injury. They're witness to subpar to negligent infection control practices, lack of disinfecting, reuse of tools from one person to the next. Inspections are where we see the best of the best and the worst of the worst and everything in between. We possibly cannot see this sitting in our offices waiting for a consumer to file a complaint. Let me frame this to you in a different way. It'd be like telling the Department of Health they don't need to license and inspect people who only tattoo the face, as there's a perceived difficult time getting a tattoo parlor license. Maybe telling the barber board if you only shave the face, there's no need for a barbershop license. Maybe telling food inspectors just skip inspections and enforcement on places that only sell French fries, but those that sell hamburgers and fries are somehow different. I'm also unclear why the legislation would remove the manager's license. Removing the license is limiting providers to do what they want. You're removing job opportunities, not creating more or removing barriers. Some salons...
You could please wrap up.
Yep, I'm at the end. Some salons will require every practitioner to have a manager's license, and eyelash technicians will be denied an opportunity. We currently have over 16,000 licensed managers of about 32,000 total, and it's not possible that all of these 16,000 peoples have a license to fulfill a board or legislative requirement. They choose to do this because they want the license or the employer requires it, and I stand for questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any additional testifiers on House File 2249? Okay, seeing none, member discussion. Representative Tice.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My voice isn't the best. I'm kind of doing my Representative Zerwas impression today.
With friends like that.
Hey. But I just want to thank Representative Gomez for bringing this forward. We've seen this the last couple of years, and I think you've been a part of it for the last couple of years as well, and I want to thank you for your tenacity to come back here and do this again. A lot of times I think we look at what we're trying to license and what the business actually is. I'm in a business that, and have been in businesses where licensing is actually an overreach in a lot of places. When you look at what they actually do and the amount of folks they have working in their salons or establishments, and what the what we're trying to do to make them compliant, it's so out of reach. In fact, I'm working on some legislation right now that would say that licensure has to apply to what you do only, not what the whole scope of the business may entail. We're looking at eyelashes only. And when you talk about some of the things that could happen, look at what women do right now. False eyelashes, you're putting adhesive on yourself. I'd rather go to a professional and have her do it and feel like I'm getting a little bit better. And when we talk about going to salons, every time I get a pedicure, I run the risk of having some kind of a, I don't want to say fungus, but I don't know what else to call it. And there's times that, yes, I have, and that's a regulated business. Things happen. So I'm really glad you're bringing this forward. I think when we look at the scope of what eyelash folks do and what we're asking them to do, it is so above everything they do, and it's so detrimental to their bottom line. Their overhead costs go up substantially, and I don't think we're hearing a lot about folks that are having a hard time with eyelash extensions. In fact, I had a wonderful conversation with the young woman who might be my daughter-in-law someday. I'm trying to make that happen, but he lives in Milwaukee, so I can't hit him up for a whole lot. But anyway, she loves it. And it really is something she enjoys, and she's tried other things like fake eyelashes and all that kind of stuff and feels this is a better route for her. So with that, thank you, Representative Gomez, and I will be voting yes again for this bill.
Thank you, Representative Tice. Is there additional member discussion? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File, where are we? 2249 be recommended to as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Ways and Means. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Representative Detmer has a testifier and has asked to go next, so thank you for your patience. I will move that House File 1657 be recommended to pass and referred to the committee, referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. This will be quick. House File 1657, a bill allows the City of Scandia to use the Subordinate Service District Authority and towns to create a Subordinate Service District of Broadband Service. And I had no idea what that service was until the City of Scandia came to me. And it's a great little town. If you ever get along Highway 95 there along the St. Croix River, you need to stop in Scandia. It's a great little town. With me today is Neil Soltis. He's the city administrator. Also, our mayor is here, but she has to can wave Mayor Christine Mayevsky, but she has another appointment she needs to get to, but she'll stay around if there's any questions that you might have, but I know that the city administrator is here too. So I'll turn it over to the city administrator.
Welcome to the committee. Thank you for your patience. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Neil Soltis. City Administrator, City of Scandia. Chair and committee members, the City of Scandia is located in the northeastern corner of Washington County. Up until 2007, it was known as New Scandia Township. We have about 4,000 residents spread over 40 square miles. If you look at the stats that come out, Washington County is considered over 98% served under deed standards with adequate broadband service. Well, Scandia residents comprise the bulk of that remaining 2%. As a matter of fact, we are the only community in Washington County where less than 50% of the people have adequate broadband service, and only one of two communities that are considered underserved in Anoka, Hennepin, Ramsey, and Washington County combined. The city's looked at how to provide adequate broadband standard or broadband service to meet state standards, and we through either a survey of internet usage and even in our comprehensive plan survey, it was overwhelmingly felt that this is one of the major issues that's facing the city of Scandia. We did a study that estimated the cost that would provide fiber to the home would be about $13 million. We have a committee looking at both alternative solution, funding partners, and grants. And ultimately, we realize that the residents of the city are going to have to pay for a portion of this. where we're at with this is that 20% of the city receives quality broadband service. And if we look, the current bonding provisions would require us to issue bonds that everybody would pay for. And the feeling is that this is really unfair and inequitable to the residents that already have that service. Excuse me. And looking at funding alternatives, one of the things that came to mind and led to this request is that the bonding provisions allow both towns or townships and counties to create what are called subordinate service districts. So what's a subordinate service district? I think most people would look at it something similar to a special assessment district, where the people who receive the benefits are the people who would pay for that infrastructure. This bill is very, very specific in that it would allow Scandia to use that the provisions for subordinate service district bonding to provide only broadband services to its residents. Additionally, it would require 25% of those impacted property owners to sign on to a petition that would allow the city to establish the subordinate service district.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any member discussion? Okay, seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 1657 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. I'm sorry. I should have offered you a close opportunity for closing remarks.
I think originally you said to the
General Register. That's a good catch. Okay. Since I gave you the opportunity, did you have any closing remarks?
Again, thank you. I've learned a lot about what Scandia is trying to do. And again, if you're ever along the St. Croix River, stop through Scandia. It's a great place. And they have a great Taco Day parade in Scandia. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 1657 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the General Register. Okay. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Representative Nelson. Representative Detmer. Representative Nelson? welcome to the committee, Representative Nelson. So we have House File. Oh, would you like to make the motion?
House File 823, motion to approve. And where does it go to?
General Register.
Sent to the General Register. And members, I have the DE2 amendment, and I'd like to move the DE2 amendment. And members, okay. From the original bill, both sides, the cities, the counties, and the agency or the businesses involved here have been working this out and trying to come with peace in the valley. We don't quite have peace in the valley, as the letter from that's in your packet says, but we do have truce in the valley, that they have come to agreement that this is the way to do that. And so, members, I'd like to add the DE2 amendment, and then I'll discuss the rest of the bill.
Okay. Representative Nelson moves the DE2 amendment. Any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. To the bill, Representative Nelson.
And remember, it's common practice in Minnesota for local governments to retain technical consultants to provide expertise in evaluating various permit applications. I believe this is generally a good thing, and it is an effective way to review applications requiring technical expertise. However, while municipalities hires and directs these outside consultants, in many cases, the applicant is required to pay the fees that are charged. Such consulting fees routinely run into thousands or tens of thousands of dollars, and depending on the complexity of the permit, depending on the individual cities, these fees may not be known to the applicant prior to receiving the bill from the consultant. Yet the applicant must pay for these consulting fees in order to receive the permit. House File 823 addresses this concern by requiring municipalities to provide the applicant an estimate of the cost of these fees that are going to be charged. The fees are from the outside consultant are passed along through the permit application. The applicant is required by the municipality and is submitted a written commitment to pay these fees, and the jurisdiction has received the formal application. The bill does not limit who the municipalities may hire as consultants, nor the amount of the fees that are charged. It only requires that the process that is transparent so that the applicant knows what these fees are up front or has an idea what they're going to be, and so they know to build that in or to fix or to roll that into what they're doing. Prior to signing off, it's similar to going to a car shop, getting car repairs, and prior to authorizing the work, saying, giving an estimate how much it does, and if it goes over that amount of that fee, they usually call you and say, well, we found this that needs to be fixed, and then the mechanic will say, do you authorize to do the work? And I've had that happen many times, and I've had my car brought in to be worked at. So, members, that's what this bill does, and we have a representative here that would like to testify, Mr. Leary.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Dan Leary. I'm the Director of State Government Affairs at T-Mobile. While I hail from Chicago, I am a proud graduate of Winona Senior High. It probably actually benefits me that Representative Pulowski isn't here anymore because he might hold that against me. And I'll be really brief because I know it's been a long morning, so I've cut some of this out. But I just wanted to say that I'm here in support of House File 823. This legislation will help make it possible for the wireless carriers to better plan for and invest in high-speed wireless broadband service across the state of Minnesota by ensuring there is transparency and predictability in third-party consultant fees assessed in municipal permit applications. In order to expand wireless coverage, we need to continue building our network. This requires significant planning for that investment. Once we have identified the need, we apply to the jurisdiction based on guidelines and permitting fees outlined in their code and application process. Many jurisdictions use third-party consultants to evaluate permit applications. We do not object to the use of consultants, and we are not here to limit the fees that they charge. But in many cases, the consultants' fees are passed on to the applicant. These fees often can run thousands and tens of thousands of dollars, as has been referenced. The consultant that is used, the work that the consultant performs, and the fees associated with that work all may be unknown to the applicant. Yet it is the responsibility of the applicant to pay those fees. This is not fair. This is what we object to, and this is what House File 823 will address. House File 823 specifically states in the bill, in instances where a consultant fee is to be passed through to the permit applicant before a city engages a consultant to review a permit application, the applicant may request a non-binding estimate of the consultant fees. The application will not be deemed complete until the city has provided the estimate to the applicant. The applicant has paid the other fees required by the city, and the applicant signs a statement that they did not rely on the estimate in their decision to make the final application. Finally, the city can require that the applicant accept the estimate before they review the application. As was referenced, some of you may recall, there was a bill last year that would have capped the fees that consultants could charge. That bill was unsuccessful, and as a result, we have worked with local governments. We actually worked with one of the consultants who's involved here in Minnesota and interested legislators. Based on that feedback that we received, we crafted the legislation here before you today. In closing, House File 823 addresses the ambiguity in the permitting process. It will ensure cost estimates are provided to applicants prior to the beginning of a project. By giving predictability for wireless carriers and promoting transparent business practices by consultants and municipalities, you, the members of this committee, can help advance high-speed broadband access for your constituents across Minnesota. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 823? Okay, seeing none, member discussion. Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I don't have any concerns with the bill. I don't have any concerns with the DE. And kind of the idea around transparency. Mr. Chair, my concerns are really more about the process and the track of this bill. This bill was introduced and referred directly to this committee and skipped the local government subcommittee. Mr. Chair, this is a bill solely focused on identifying cities and townships and making them do something. The first line is, for the purpose of this section, city means a home rule charter or statutory city. The retitlement is a bill for an act relating to cities requiring a city. And then it goes on. So, Mr. Chair, if we're not going to send bills that only, solely deal with local governments and creating new mandates for those governments to the local government committee, I am baffled to understand why the committee exists.
Okay. You seem to be looking for, I guess I would just repeat what I said before, that subcommittees are not obligated to hear everything that might arguably fall within their jurisdiction.
All right. Well, Mr. Chair, this is, I think, the third example today of a bill that the majority has set up this process and then decided just not to follow it. I'll make the motion to refer the bill to a local government. I'll ask for a roll call. Not that I think I'm going to win the votes, but I want yet another recorded vote of the majority deciding not to follow the own process they've decided to establish.
Okay, thank you. So the motion's on the table. Representative Elkins, you were next on the list.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually agree with most of what Representative Zerwa says, but like him, I think that the bill is okay. I can support this, but I do think that, you know, based on the written testimony that we received, that I think this is an example of something that might have benefited from actually being chewed up in local government first.
Okay. I'm inclined to just lay this bill over for the time being. Would that be acceptable, Representative? I think as chair, I have the authority to do that, correct?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, so I'll just do that, I think, at this point. I think there's still some discussion on this bill. So thank you, Representative Nelson. I do have one additional item of business that I wanted to mention. In your packets, you'll see a fiscal note related to House File 1397, thank you. So this is the Daylight Savings Time bill that we discussed on Tuesday. The motion I'd been planning on making on Tuesday was to send the bill to the General Register. That morning I got a fiscal note that the Senate had requested showing there would be a cost, which was kind of a surprise to me because I wasn't expecting that. So House Fiscal, I moved to send it to Ways and Means. House Fiscal in the interim requested a revised fiscal note, which is in your packets there. I've spoken to Representative Zerwas about this. There is a zero cost to it. So with the committee's indulgence, I would like to move to reconsider the motion that we made on Tuesday to bring that bill up again so that we could just send it directly to the General Register. And I've spoken to the chair of Ways and Means, and he's okay with that plan as well. So I will make that motion. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Okay. Opposed? Okay. The bill is before us again. And I will move that House File 1397 be recommended pass and be referred to the General Register. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay. The motion carries. So the bill is on its way to what I view as the correct place. Thank you for your indulgence, members of the committee. There's no additional business before this committee, and with that, we are adjourned.